Turn in your Bible to Exodus 14, Exodus chapter 14, and we're going to start at verse 10. The context of this passage is, for those who know the story or do not, Israel was captive in Egypt, and Moses is leading them out, and they are on their way to the promised land, and God in his wisdom decided to take them through the wilderness rather than through a direct route in order to protect them from their own lack of courage in case they were to get into a battle. That the Lord said that he would fear if Israel got into a battle that they would want to go back to Egypt. So they've been on this long journey, and in a miraculous way they've been led by the cloud and the pillar of fire. And then we come to verse 10, and we find out that Egypt, although they let him go, are now coming after them again, and we'll pick up at verse 10. And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. Then they said to Moses, "Because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt so with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, 'Let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians'? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness." And Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see again no more forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace." And the Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward, but lift up your rod and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it. And the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea. And I indeed will harden their hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them. So I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, his chariots and his horsemen. Then the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, when I have gained honor for myself over Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen." And the angel of God, who went before the camp of Israel, moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud went from before them and stood behind them. So it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel. Thus it was a cloud and darkness to the one, and it gave light by night to the other, so that the one did not come near the other all that night. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. So the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on the dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. And the Egyptians pursued and went after them in the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. Now it came to pass in the morning watch that the Lord looked down upon the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud, and he troubled the army of the Egyptians. And he took off their chariot wheels so that they drove them with difficulty. And the Egyptians said, "Let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea, that the waters may come back upon the Egyptians, on their chariots, and on their horsemen." And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and when the morning appeared, the sea returned to its full depth while the Egyptians were fleeing into it. So the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. Then the waters returned and covered the chariots, the horsemen, and all the army of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. Not so much as one of them remained. But the children of Israel had walked on dry land in the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. So the Lord saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Thus Israel saw the great work which the Lord had done in Egypt. So the people feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant Moses. Now if we continue in Corinthians where we've been, I'm going to read a couple of verses. You don't need to turn. 1 Corinthians 10, 1 through 6. "Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud. All passed through the sea. All were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. All ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink. For they that drank of the spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Now these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things, as they also lusted.
Have any of you heard of Ryan Leaf? Few of you football fans may have heard of him. Ryan Leaf, a man who was destined to be a superstar quarterback, led his team in high school to win the state championship, was MVP of the tournament, in college was described as, quote, a tremendous quarterback. The blitzes didn't faze him. He is huge. He is what the NFL guys are looking for. He is big time. He was nominated for the Heisman Trophy. He was the second player drafted in 1998, and he received a six-year, $31.4 million contract with an $11.25 million signing bonus. Got over $11 million just to write his name. When he joined the San Diego Chargers, he won his first three games in the exhibition season, and the team was convinced he would take them back to the Super Bowl. Yet this past July, Ryan just didn't show up for training camp. He had retired after only 3 years and four different teams. He had started only 18 games and had a record of 4 wins, 14 losses, and a terrible 48.8 quarterback rating. Listen to what some players said of him. Ryan Leaf single-handedly wrecked the Chargers franchise. He joined a team that had been to the Super Bowl a few years earlier. Pro Bowl strong safety Rodney Harrison described the experience as, quote, a nightmare you cannot even imagine. Another player said, Ryan's worst nightmare has always been Ryan. He threw 15 interceptions and only 2 touchdown passes his rookie season. Chargers general manager Bobby Beathard said, I've never seen an athlete work harder at destroying himself and his career than this guy did. David Mazzellis writes, Leaf managed to blame everyone but himself for his troubles. A boiling point was reached when, after fumbling 3 times, throwing 2 interceptions, and completing only 1 of 15 passes, I think I could do that, in a game against the Chiefs, Leaf flew into a tirade, hurling obscenity-laden insults at a reporter before being dragged out of the locker room by teammates. Fans hated him, teammates hated him, coaches hated him. In only 3 seasons in the NFL, he was listed as in the top 10 least likable players. Brian Carnell summarizes his career. In a horrible career, Leaf threw almost 3 interceptions for every touchdown, alienated teammates everywhere he went, and generally wasted the physical prowess that many of us armchair quarterbacks would kill for. Isn't that a sad, sad thing? To watch someone who has all the ingredients of success fail miserably. You know, the Apostle Paul envisioned himself being able to do that. Look at 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 27. He says, but I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified. Disqualified. That word means not standing the test. It is used of soil that may look good but doesn't produce in Hebrews 6:8. It's used of metal that doesn't stand up to the heat. Thistleton describes this. This is a good quote, a good definition. That which does not prove itself to be such as it ought. That which does not prove itself to be such as it ought. The test reveals failures. It's like a runner who has well-defined legs and a slick running suit and light running shoes. He's got a water bottle with his picture on it and those cool aerodynamic sunglasses. He's got everything to make him look like a great runner. But in the midst of the race, he looks up in the stands and he notices a fan drinking a Coke. And he thinks, what is he drinking a Coke for? I'm the one who's really thirsty. I deserve that Coke. And he runs off after the fan who has the Coke. Obviously, he's going to be disqualified. All the externals of having the right outfit and the right physique and the right management and all the rest mean nothing if it's not proven to be effective in the test. He proves to be a flop. Well, the Corinthians may at this point say, listen, Paul, how can you say you're going to be disqualified? You know, we're not going to be disqualified. We've prayed the prayer. We've been baptized. We've partaken in the Lord's Supper. Disqualified. So Paul moves from an athletic metaphor, the athletic realm, the end of chapter 9, to the historical realm in chapter 10. Let's read those first four verses again, and as we read those, see if you can identify the word that emphasized, that is over and over used, five different times, that tells us what Paul is trying to communicate in these first four verses. Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. What is the word? All. Five times, one sentence. All. 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 What is the point? Point number one. Everybody received the same blessing. Everybody was blessed. Everybody received the same benefit. Look at the benefits. All our fathers were under the cloud. Can you imagine having a cloud like that? You wake up in the morning, you walk out your door, and there's a cloud waiting for you. And it directs you through your day, telling you where to go. I mean, it's better than the GPS. A personal system of locating where you are and where to go. Notice he says, all our fathers. Why does he say our fathers? He's talking to Corinthians. Aren't they Gentiles? That tells you a little bit of Paul's theology. Paul believed that the Gentiles were grafted into the covenant people. Romans 11, 17 to 24. They are now part of spiritual Israel, Galatians 6, 16. And they are spiritually related to Abraham, Romans 4, 11, and to Moses, 1 Corinthians 10. So, these people who were not a people have suddenly become a people. Have suddenly been connected in history to all that God has done. We, Gentiles, who are not a people and have no, you know, real redemptive history, are suddenly connected with what God has been doing through the ages. And we, spiritually speaking, this doesn't make us Jews nationally, but spiritually speaking, are now related to Abraham and Moses. And so we can call him our father. And that's what Paul does. He says all our fathers were under the cloud. Not only did he provide direction, but he provided protection. Notice it said all passed through the sea. How did he do that? Notice that verse 2. All were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. What does that mean? Did Moses baptize all the Israelites? No, it doesn't say they were baptized by Moses. What does it say? Baptized into Moses. What does that mean? I mean, picture that scene. Pharaoh's army is behind the children of Israel, ready to kill them. The cloud that had led them, that provided shade in the day and was a fire at night, moved from in front of the people and over the people to behind the people to protect them from Pharaoh's army. So you've got this army behind them. You've got this, as they're walking through the Red Sea, you've got this wall of water on one side and a wall of water on the other side. And Moses out front. The children of Israel, who were so short on faith and any understanding of what God was going to do, were baptized into Moses by identifying with him as their leader. I'm with him. I mean, the guy who raised his hand and the waters parted, the spokesman for God, we're with him. I mean, they were literally funneled into Moses in the sense of following him, being associated with him, identifying with him. That's what happens in baptism, too, for a believer. It is picturing us being identified with Christ. I'm trusting in him. He is the way of salvation. So Moses becomes a picture of that for the children of Israel. They were baptized into Moses. And that's why Exodus 14:31, the last verse, the chapter we just read, thus Israel saw the great work which the Lord had done in Egypt. So the people feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant Moses. Not only that, verse 3, there was provision. All ate the same spiritual food. He's speaking here of the manna, that heavenly concession stand that God brought to the children of Israel on a daily basis. All drank the same spiritual drink, that instant public water system that God could call water out of a rock in the middle of a desert to prove his ability to provide for his people. That spiritual rock that followed them. And that rock was Christ. There's a tradition among Israelites, a Jewish legend, that a rock actually followed Israel. Just picture this rock rolling along with the people of Israel. And a lot of scholars say that Paul is referring to that, but notice he's not talking about a physical rock there. He says that spiritual rock, in other words, just as that rock was used by God to provide for his people, so the pre-incarnate Christ, Jesus Christ, was among his people even then and was providing for his people. He was their provision in time of need. So everyone was blessed. Isn't this what we dream of? Isn't this what you hear skeptics say quite often? You know, if God would just miraculously pay my bills, heal my body, protect me from every bad thing that could possibly happen to me. If God would just work miraculously like that, I would have no trouble believing in him and no trouble following him. I would even go to the mission field. I would do anything. And yet Paul is saying, wait, 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 you're not connected to history. You're not connected to reality. Look at the children of Israel. They all did this. They all did that. God did this for all of them. They all received the blessings. Everybody was blessed. But number two, almost everybody was judged. Wait, those two aren't supposed to go together. Almost everybody was judged. Look at verse 5. But with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. And most of them, literally in the Greek, it reads the majority, and it's a dramatic understatement. How many weren't judged? Two. Two made it into the promised land. The vast majority were judged for their disobedience. And it's not just a passive or mild judgment. It says God was not well pleased. Again, another understatement. You want to know how not well pleased he was? Their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. They perished. They were overthrown. The word literally means to be strewn out. God decimated the children of Israel. And their bodies were strewn throughout the wilderness like an atomic bomb had blown off. Say, what is the point? Is the point that Israel is really wicked and bad? No, he tells us the point. Look at verse 6. Now, these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. Let's keep going. Verse 7. And do not become idolaters as were some of them, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell. Nor let us tempt Christ as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. Nor complain as some of them also complained and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. So what Paul is doing is the same thing he just described at the end of chapter 9 in his own personal life. Is I'm guarding myself, I'm putting my body under, I'm guarding what I think and do, lest I be disqualified. He's saying, you want an example of that? Look at the children of Israel. I mean, they had all the blessings. They were all blessed, yet almost all of them were judged. So this is the third big point in this section. Not everybody needs to repeat the same mistake. Not everybody needs to be judged. Because some people say, well, what is the use? I mean, what's the use? If God is going to judge everybody anyway, why don't I just do what I want to do? That's the thought of a proud person. I'll just live any way I want. If he's going to be like that, if he didn't heal me when I wanted to be healed, if he didn't provide what I wanted to be provided for, if he didn't do everything I wanted him to do, then I'll just do my own thing. And if he wants to toast me, that's fine. And God is saying, no, you don't understand. I have recorded these examples so that you can learn, heed, hear, so that you don't have to repeat the same thing. There is no reason for the people of God to continue to repeat what God has already shown to be true in the past. Listen, wake up, heed the warning. Let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. Stop the lunacy. God is like a parent of a four-year-old. The kid keeps putting his hand on the stove despite the fact that the burner is hot, just to see for sure if it's really hot. And God is saying, no. I've given you warnings. I've told you things. Some of you think it's smart of you to have to learn everything by experience, right? I mean, some people, you've heard it. I've heard it. I've even said stupid things like that myself. You know, I'm hard-headed. I just have to do it in order to learn. And God is saying, you're a fool. Why keep doing it? Why keep touching the burner so that you'll know it's hot? Why keep having to prove the fact that you've got to try everything in order to learn something? No, the wise man looks back at history, looks at the examples of others, sees the way God has been working, and listens. Take heed. Don't keep repeating. Not everyone needs to be judged. You see, Israel had God's daily provision and protection. He instantly provided for their needs. And yet they thought these blessings would make them immune to God's judgment. And so they were characterized, as verses 6 through 12 described, as by idolatry and immorality and presumption and grumbling. Now tonight, we're only going to hit half of this morning. Tonight we're going to come back, Lord willing, and deal with some of the specifics of verses 6 through 12 and talk about some big questions that come up. Did Paul believe he could lose his salvation? And these are very strong warnings to people who were the people of God. And superficial answers aren't enough. But for this morning, I want us just to understand and wrestle with one basic question, and that is this. Can you envision yourself being judged by God? Can you picture yourself being judged by God? And I know some of you may say, I think about that every day. I grew up in a church where that's all I heard. Some of you, that's all you heard all your life, so you've blown it away. You got sick of hearing that because in many times that is overemphasized. But in our culture in general, we are not overemphasizing God's judgment, are we? Many of us have a mindset. When I asked that question, you probably thought, well, I just don't think about that a lot. You know, the Old Testament God was kind of mean. He judged God's people. But God of the New Testament is a God of grace, right? And that means it's all going to work out. It's all going to be okay. Is that what Paul says here? Is he says, the reason I want you to look at the Old Testament is because that's the way God used to be, but he's turned over a new leaf. You know, he's become a modern, domesticated God, user-friendly, you know? So it's okay now. You can just count on the fact that if you're okay, God's okay, it's all going to be okay. And Paul is saying, I'm writing for the opposite reason. Wake up. God will judge you and me. Paul had a very real sense of that. Even as an apostle, he had a sense. He had a picture. He could envision himself losing the faith, being judged, and going to hell. What? I mean, how can that be? Tonight we want to wrestle with how can that be. But for right now, can you picture yourself being judged by God? Standing before God, presenting all your reasons. God, you know, you remember when I was a little kid, I prayed that prayer. You remember when I was baptized. You remember I took the medicine of immortality. It's what the church fathers would call the Lord's Supper. You know, I did things for you. I went to church for years. Look at my family. Our home, we had some things in our home that, as for me and my house, we will serve you, God, you. And can you picture God setting all of that aside and judging you. See, for many of us, these things that we cling to are no different than what the radical Muslims cling to. In the newspaper in Iraq, December 1st, there was an article that promised that any Muslim that fought against Israel or the United States and shed his blood and died was guaranteed paradise. This is what the article, this is how it read. That martyrs have a great status in the eyes of Allah. With the first drop of blood, the martyr is given absolution and he can see his seat in paradise. He is spared the torture of the grave. He is secure from the great horror of judgment. He is crowned with the crown of glory. He marries black-eyed virgins. He can vouch for 70 of his relatives to enter paradise. When you talk about a backstage pass, that one action of shedding your blood in jihad is going to wipe out everything and ensure you an immunity from judgment. And most of us look at that and we say, man, that is both pitiful and ludicrous. And yet, I believe our churches are packed with people who have the same thinking. Maybe not shedding blood for Allah, but we have little tokens of things that we've done, and our faith rests in those little things. And when we go through periods of doubt or disobedience, we cling to those little things to give us assurance that we will not come under judgment. And God has given us passages like this to shake us out of our comfort zone and to say, wait, who are you really trusting? Where is your confidence? Do you wear some of these activities as kind of a special vest that protects you from any kind of judgment? God is saying he doesn't work that way. There is no magic act or ritual that permits us to engage in wicked lifestyles without fear of judgment. This is how I would summarize it. We are saved only by God's grace in Christ, period. Just like Israel didn't do anything to be saved from Egypt. But he doesn't rescue us so that we can use our liberty for the flesh. Just like he didn't deliver Israel from Egypt so that they could go out and live in immorality and idolatry and presumption and grumbling. It's not why he rescued them. So take heed. Take heed. I've mentioned Charles Simeon before. He was the pastor of Trinity Church in Cambridge for almost 50 years. And if you look at someone like Charles Simeon, who went through an unbelievable life of difficulty, and you see the staying power of this man, he didn't just start to run the race, he finished the race. And too many of us are good starters. We come off and we run. And then we start growing weary and getting distracted and getting driven off course and looking up in the stands and wondering why, God, why can't I have this and why can't I have that? And you think of somebody like Simeon, and I read men like that to find out what gave them that staying power. I don't want to just start. By God's grace, I want to finish well. Paul had a deep sense of that. I don't want to just run the race for a little bit. I want to fight the fight, run the race, and finish well for God's glory. Somebody like Simeon, Hanley Moule, captures the essence of Simeon's secret of longevity. And he describes it this way: before honor is humility. And he has been growing, get this, he has been growing downwards year by year under the stern discipline of difficulty met in the right way, the way of close and adoring communion with God. Those two things were the heartbeat of Simeon's inner life, growing downward in humility, growing upward in adoring communion with God. Do you catch that? I know we're skipping over a lot of big questions, but we're getting real close to the heart of what the Apostle Paul is trying to communicate to us in this very serious passage. Simeon didn't just grow up spiritually. He grew down. As his humility grew down, his adoration grew up. Just like an oak tree whose root systems go deep into the ground, and the higher that tree grows and the bigger those branches and the wider it spreads, the deeper the root system goes, in contrast to the pine trees often that grow around here that have a tiny little root system, and first ice storm, they're gone. This is what Paul is warning us of. Some of you just, you love the idea, he's writing to the Corinthians, of the big oak tree of ministry and reputation and spiritual gifts. I mean, Paul described that at the beginning of 1 Corinthians. You guys are blessed. You have been blessed. But remember, blessing alone does not make you immune from judgment. You can't rest in that blessing. So there has to be an increasing growing downward while you're growing upward. Listen to what Simeon wrote. This is after being a Christian for 40 years. He said, "There are two objects that I have ever desired for these 40 years to behold. The one is my own vileness." Now, if you said that today, people would look at you and say, you need therapy. But Simeon was well aware. There was something about this man, even with his great success in ministry and as a scholar, that after 40 years of being a Christian, he was more aware of his own vileness than even he was at the beginning. That a Christian is aware. They grow deeper in humility as they grow higher in adoration and maturity. But see, that vileness wasn't alone. And many of you, you grew up in churches where the vileness was emphasized, but the adoration wasn't. And so you became consumed with the vileness. But he's not done yet. He said, "Yes, I'm aware of my vileness. And the other is the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. And I have always thought that they should be viewed together." And I would say, I don't even think we have to deliberately view them. Because I think as we grow in our adoration of Christ, not just the things that surround Christ, not just the church stuff or ministry stuff or reputation stuff, but as we truly grow in our adoration of Christ, there will be a corresponding deepening of our awareness of our own ability to be deceived, defiled, and judged. And so we become well aware of the fact that while I deserve judgment, my only hope is in Jesus Christ. And so I fix my eyes on Him. And my assurance of not being judged doesn't come from any particular little activity that I have done, as wonderful as those are and as crucial as those fruits are as evidence of my faith. But my assurance comes as I have fixed my eyes on Him. Back to our question. Are you growing deeper? I mean, as you quiet yourself before the Lord, is there a deeper sense, an awareness of your own depravity? The verse that Ross began with, let's look at that in Psalm 147. As he read that, it really hit me. I hadn't heard that for a long time, and it struck at the heart again of what Paul is communicating. God is described as one who heals the brokenhearted and binds up their wounds. He counts the number of stars. His understanding is infinite. But then verse 6 of Psalm 147, The Lord lifts up the humble. He casts the wicked down to the ground. Verse 10. He does not delight in the strength of the horse. In this verse, he takes no pleasure in the legs of a man. I mean, what does that mean? Just break your leg and you realize how crucial your legs are to you. And especially in their day, before cars or any other mode of transportation. And you can get a man like Ryan Leaf, who was built with thighs like a tree trunk, had everything, the physical prowess that anyone would be proud of and could place their confidence in. Surely he will succeed as a football player. But God is saying to us, just like Paul was communicating in 1 Corinthians 9, I have to beat my body down, because if I place any confidence in my own ability, whether it's the strength of the horse or the legs of a man in that day, or the ability to make money today, or have a good reputation, or produce, or a portfolio, or whatever it is we put our confidence in, he is saying, God is saying, I'm not impressed. Even in the ministry, a church that's growing, full seats, whatever else, he's saying, that doesn't impress me. Are you growing downward? That's what I'm looking for. As you grow upward. So God is looking at this thing from a totally different perspective. And unless we're becoming coming closer and closer to his perspective, we're setting ourselves up to be in opposition to him, because he does what? He resists the proud and he gives grace to the humble. God is not neutral toward our pride. He will fight it. He has got to fight it, or else he's not God, because there's only one true God. And when we put our confidence in ourselves, we set ourselves up for judgment. Verse 11, the opposite. The Lord takes pleasure in those who fear him and in those who hope in his mercy. Lord, this is hard stuff. We can easily get confused about what this passage says. We want a tight, logical system, 1, 2, 3, to settle our hearts and know where we are. Just like Israel, Lord, they thought they knew what they needed. So, Lord, I pray as we stop in the middle of this passage without real resolution, that your Spirit would move among us and just sober us, Lord. Wake us up. Stir us up. There are some here who have never thought about your judgment, that you are a fearful God. That your power is a power that makes nuclear weapons seem tame. That the heat of your wrath will consume us in a nanosecond. That an anger and a power that we cannot even imagine. Lord, you do not flaunt that power, because that is not what... You do not delight in destroying people, Lord. You delight in your glory. And Lord, we long to delight in your glory, not our glory. Our glory is puny. It's superficial. It's transient. It comes and it goes. It impresses other people, but it doesn't impress you. I pray, God, that even this morning, your Spirit would drive your truth into our hearts, and that some who have never considered your judgment would realize with great fear and trembling your power. You are not a God to be trifled with. We cannot take for granted your blessings. You have dumped on us your goodness, not so that we can abuse it, but so that we can be deepened and grow stronger in humility and dependence. Please, Lord, grant us the humility to cry out to you and save us from ourselves. And Lord, for those who know what it's like to be consumed with their own vileness and under your judgment, I pray even now they would see that you have made a way of escape, that you are faithful, and that they would hope in your mercy. Only you, Lord, can do this work of breaking down and bringing to yourself. So we are trusting you for that. In Jesus' name, amen.